Welcome to Disrupt Disruption, a series of intimate interviews with global thought leaders and practitioners operating at the intersection of business, leadership, and technology. We're discussing all things innovation and disruption and how to not only survive, but thrive in these times of exponentially accelerating change. Trusted by CEOs, founders, and leaders globally for the latest take on business models, methods, culture, and leadership, we cut to the chase, debunk the hype, and get real. You're in great company. I'm your host, Pascal Finette, co-founder of Be Radical.
Hey everybody, Pascal here. We are back with another episode of Disrupt Disruption. And today, I'm really excited to have Grant Wood here. He's the CEO and the chief innovator at Notion Labs. They have as their tagline, and I think this is a perfect starting point for our conversation today, become known for innovation again. And when you go to the website, and we'll make sure that you have the URL in the show notes, of course, there is a whole section on innovation anti-patterns. And that is perfect for us to start our conversation. Grant, first of all, I'm stoked to have you on this podcast. Thanks so much for being here.
Pascal, thank you. It's an honor to be on your program. I'm a big fan of the podcast, and so I'm excited to have this conversation.
Grant, let's talk about the again. Your website, in many ways, is already an anti-pattern to most of the websites I see where people sell innovation and disruption and so on. And I found myself nodding a ton when I like scroll through your website and the points you're making there. I'm curious, talk a little bit about the work you're doing at Notion Labs, to get people to innovate again.
Yeah. Well, thank you. That's all very, very kind of you to say. I've been working, doing some form of innovation for most of my career. And the thing that always sort of struck me early in my career was the number of people that I met, and they would tell me about these extraordinary things that they're working on. And then when I would see them like a couple of years later and I would say, oh, hey, you were working on, you know, this thing and it was really amazing and I was really excited about it. I was excited for them. And the number of times that the person would come back and say, oh, well, yeah, you know, yeah, we're not really doing that anymore and we kind of whatever. And I would kind of go, oh, but it was, you know, it was so good and it was this and that and whatever. And oh, yeah, yeah. And it always really struck me that it was different than sort of what you would expect, right? Like, these are all people who are really great at innovating and really great at creating things. And I started noticing the failure scenarios, the things that were going on that were causing these things to fail weren't really what I expected. It wasn't really people coming back going like, yeah, there was a real customer fit, or we had a supply chain problem. We just couldn't get the magic unicorn hair that we needed in order to make the thing work, right? The things that are sort of on our checklist for innovation. Instead, more it was always like, oh, well, there was a thing and, you know, we had this acquisition and then there was a whatever and then the downturn. And it was always really kind of vague. And this really struck me, sort of something was going on here. How is it that everybody was running into these same kinds of things when everything that we know about innovation was all about the process that you're using, all about picking really great ideas, all about here's the track that you need to get on and go do something that's really extraordinary, right? How to remake the world from the things that are in your imagination. And these things weren't kind of matching up. And this really started to bother me because through this process, I was starting to predict. I would hear ideas and go like, I don't think that's going to work. I don't think that's going to fail. And I really got to the point where I thought I had this weird superpower. And it's not a fun superpower to have when you're telling people they're going to fail when they haven't even begun. What was it that I was noticing now? What was it that I was seeing? And so it really started bothering me that I knew this. And I started stepping back going like, okay, there's got to be something here. What is it? And I had an opportunity with a client to help prove internally why one of their teams was so good at innovation relative to all the other major divisions that they had. Why was this one group known both internally and externally for how good they were? And this was sort of a turning point for me in how I started talking and thinking about innovation with people. Because we went back in time and we wanted to show exactly how successful they were at getting great things out of the door. And so we went and we looked in their accounting system and we worked with their HR people and we looked at staff and we interviewed former employees. We did all these interesting things and we took a snapshot of 18 months in time and we said, okay, everything that you were working on at the beginning of this date, we're then going to move forward 18 months and everything will have either succeeded, will be still in progress, or will have failed. And then we had some nuance around, did it succeed and did it launch and did it succeed, or did it launch and then it failed? And then, you know, if it failed, like, why did it fail? We went and we looked at this and we were absolutely blown away. In that 18 month period of time, they had a 100% failure rate. 100% of the things that they had been working on at that first date, at the end of that 18 months, they were no longer working on, and they had no idea. They had no idea. In fact, during that 18 month period of time, won two separate awards, one internal and one external, for how innovative they had been and for the amazing work that they were doing. And so it raised these really fascinating questions. How is this possible? We specifically set out to show, like, that they were better at this than other people, because it was sort of anecdotal and they're like, well, let's get some numbers behind this. And so the problem now was, well, why? Why is this happening? And more importantly, how do we not understand this? And so this set me on this interesting journey to figure out, why is our perception of how good we are at doing innovation so different than the reality? And now, once I saw this, I couldn't not see it everywhere else I went. So that was sort of the seed for what I started calling reality-based innovation. It's sort of this idea that if you really want to set out and change the world, you need to fully embrace the reality of who you are, the company you have today as it is today, with the people you have today as they are today, and the customers that you have today as they are today. And if you don't fully embrace those things, then you have almost no chance of doing the next set of things, which is to fully embrace the reality of the work that you're doing to try and go do something that's really interesting. And the reason that I think that that's important, which comes back to the company tagline, you know, become known for innovation again, is that every company that you can name, every company that you know of and that you're aware of, all of these companies did something nobody had done before. Yeah. That got them to be big. And they continued to succeed, and sometimes through acquisition or through really changing themselves and reinventing themselves through time. And they still exist today because someone did something extraordinary in the beginning. But that thing, that founder spark, the activities and the things that make founders successful are very rarely the things that make ongoing established companies successful. And so my take on this is to come into an organization and to first and foremost work with the amazing people that they have and to say, okay, let's talk about reality. And let's really understand that there are any number of ways we can go forward and do things. But if we don't understand why these things tend to fail, then no matter which methodology we choose to try and do something amazing, the likelihood that we're going to succeed is very, very slim. So a couple of pieces of context here. As I started getting into, like, looking at why things fail, you know, there's lots of research that's been done on this. There's lots of science out there. Generally, you can find lots of lists on the 10 reasons that innovation programs tend to fail. And those 10 reasons tend to map then against a lot of our innovation methodologies, right? So again, it's things like customer fit. You know, we couldn't find a good customer fit. It was a brand mismatch. You know, no one believed that we could actually deliver that because that wasn't our brand promise. Supply chain issues, channel issues, right? But as I went in and I looked at things, what I kept finding over and over again is, while there may have been elements around programs failing that were related to those specific things, what I saw more often than anything, in fact, the number one reason that innovation programs actually failed, was that we simply shut them down. I mean, it's really kind of extraordinary. It is overwhelmingly the number one reason. And so you think, like, well, how is that the case? Like, here's these top 10 reasons why things fail. Yeah. But the number one reason that things fail is that they're just shut down. That doesn't match, right? The book says this, and yet in reality, it's this. So, like, what the heck is going on? And that's sort of where the anti-patterns came in. It was basically starting to understand what were the real reasons that innovation programs failed. And what I realized through a lot of interviews and looking in different kinds of organizations was that the thing that kept happening over and over again was that these innovation programs were being set up with a particular set of expectations that ignored everything but, did we have a great idea and what's the process that we're using? And by focusing just on those two things, we didn't have enough focus on the environment that we were doing the innovation in. Mm. And what happens then is that we fail to understand that these things are taking place within reality, within real human beings and real organizations, happening in a real economy. And so there's all of these other things that were not being taken into account by our innovation processes. So generally, what I have come up with is sort of a theory as to sort of why all of this works. So first, I should talk about something that I call a left-hand, right-hand decision. So at different times during your cycle, during your year, if you've gone to business school, you're taught there's different times that we plan things, right? So you've got your annual sales planning, you've got your annual budgeting, you've got your five-year strap that you're working on, you've got your innovation roadmap that you're doing, you've got all these different things. You've got sort of the seasons of your business. And the expectation is this is the time where we're prioritizing where our resources are going. Mm-hmm. But in reality, we are reprioritizing our resource allocations far more frequently. And these things lead to this left-hand, right-hand decision. So a left-hand, right-hand decision goes like this. Hold out your hands in front of you. And in your right hand, you are holding all of the forward-looking, amazing innovation programs that you've got going on in your company right now. Okay? It's all of the new unicorns that are going to grow up and completely change your life. It's going to set your company up for the next 5 to 10 years. It's going to put you personally on the map. These are all the greatest ideas that you've ever had. And these are the things that are going to change the world, right? But also, they're in development and they have never generated a penny in revenue and they have never saved you a penny in cost because they're not done. From the moment they began, they are a 100% failure. Because they have yet to launch, okay? Now, in your left hand, you have all of your existing products and services and experiences. And along with it, all the things that come with that. You have upset customers and supply chain headaches and internal politics and all the different things that go along with actually operationalizing a successful business. When we ask someone to reprioritize, they make this decision. They look at their left hand and their right hand and they decide which of these things are going to actually move forward. Where are we going to actually allocate our resources? So the expectation then from a manager's perspective, from the business school perspective, is that we've got these specific times when we're reprioritizing. But the reality is there's a number of different trigger events that happen that cause us as individuals and as organizations to begin to reprioritize. So generally, they fall into three broad categories. The first is a leadership change. And this can be any leadership change in the organization. Someone is hired, someone is fired, someone is promoted. That one actually ends up being absolutely devastating the innovation program. Or someone even just is moved within the organization. It's not a promotion. It's just, hey, you were over here and now you're going to be over here. And you've seen this everywhere. It's not just a senior leader. It's also someone like someone who's running your loading dock or someone who is a scrum master within an organization. That change, that leadership change creates an uncertainty within the organization and it causes people to hesitate. It causes people to not be able to take as many risks. And so they're unlikely to move forward with the things that they were working on before. The next category is organizational changes. Obviously, if people are changing, organizations are also changing. Something happens because you are acquiring a company or you are merging two divisions together or you are a horizontally aligned matrix organization and now you're going to be a vertically aligned international whatever you're going to be, right? Anytime one of these things happen, it's not even the moment that it happens. Sometimes it's just the feeling that it's about to happen. If you're a large entity that's constantly acquiring companies like every 3 or 4 years, there's just too many of these weird side organizations that we have, and we have to reorg in order to really just bring everything back under the main tent. And you can sense when it's going to happen. And as people sense that, they don't know where they're going to land. They don't know where they're going to end up. So it's very unlikely that they're going to begin something, which in and of itself is an act of risk-taking. That's what all innovation is. Innovation is risk-taking. So now if you're injecting uncertainty into the organization or even the hint that things may become more uncertain, what you're doing is you're removing people's ability to take risks. The third category of trigger events are existential things. And these are all over the map. It's everything from, you know, we're all very familiar with what happens when there's a global pandemic, but it can be an economic downturn or a suspected economic downturn. One of the big ones is quarterly earnings reports. How many innovation programs have absolutely been slaughtered because we think we're going to have a bad quarter, or we're going to miss earnings by, you know, a couple pennies, or we think we're going to have a bad earnings call 3 quarters from now. So you know what? We're going to do some belt tightening now so that we can come in and do something, right? It's the expectations of the outside world and the things that are happening to us that create external pressure or external uncertainties that cause us to change our behavior and to create the circumstances under which we now take and we do a left-hand, right-hand thing. And it goes beyond kind of the normal business things. There could be a hurricane. There could be a scandal. There could be something like news in our industry, like our biggest competitor just bought our biggest customer, right? All of those things are things that we now need to demonstrate both internally and externally that we are handling that situation. And when we're doing that, we're asking ourselves to reprioritize. And again, innovation is an act of risk-taking. So when someone feels uncertain, how much risk are they willing to take? Well, we're all different. We're all individuals who can withstand and sustain different amounts of risk. And through time, we as individuals will take on huge amounts of risk or very small amounts of risk. And it's not just because of what's going on at work. It's also in our personal life. If right now I am suddenly taking care of a parent who needs a lot more help, you know what? I maybe just need things at work to be much, much easier. And it's easier if I'm not asking all of my bosses and all of my coworkers to take huge amounts of risks all the time, right? So if you plot out on a timeline how long you think your innovation program is going to last, and now you just look back at the last 5 years and you categorize all of the different kinds of events that I just told you about, just how often did they happen? And just pick that timeline up and lay it down over your next 5 years and assume they're all going to happen again. How many of them are overlapping? How many of them are happening at the exact same time? And how many periods of time on that timeline have no uncertainty that have been added because someone has left or because something happened in the outside world? And now ask yourself, how many of the ideas are you working on right now that can withstand that much uncertainty and that many trigger events? And how many reprioritizations can that idea withstand when, again, from the moment you've begun it, it's a failure. It's a failure all the way until the moment it succeeds and it launches. So what I try and help you do is to basically say, look, let's really understand the environments that we're actually doing our innovation in. Because now, if we understand this and we understand that there's uncertainty and the uncertainty is causing us to maybe not move forward with these things, because again, it's not the business school like, well, I'm going to put 20% of my energy into innovation. It is, oh my gosh, there is so much uncertainty. And I'm looking at these things in my right hand. And while it might make my career, the truth is that these things in my left hand, if I don't hit my numbers within maybe a half a point of GDP growth over the next 3 quarters, I'm not going to have a job when the unicorn leaves the barn. And so we'll just put it on hold for now, or we'll just put it on the back burner, or we'll just set it aside. You know, here's a hint. In my entire career, I have only seen one project ever come off hold. And it was actually done by a leader who had heard me say that these things, once they're on hold, they never come back. And he just wanted to prove to me that that wasn't true. So he actually deliberately went and reinvigorated the project, which I thought was quite funny. But this is sort of the thing that I think matters most. These big trigger events are only part of the equation then. So Pascal, you brought up the anti-patterns. So how do they come into play? In addition to these major events that are happening that directly or actively create feelings of uncertainty within our organization, there's also sort of what I call the background uncertainty. And I'll give you a little bit of a story. I work with a lot of different kinds of organizations, and a big part of helping people to curate their pipeline for innovation or help them come up with ideas or develop what we call qualified concepts, we build a lot of trust with people. It really, you know, innovation is risk-taking. And in order to do it well, you have to create an environment where there's a lot of trust and people have to trust you. And once you do that, people start confiding in you. A leader from an organization, actually global organization, responsible for all of their moonshots. Like, this is the person responsible for doing all of their big, big innovation. Comes into the meeting early. I'm the first one there. And he comes in and goes, hey, I'm glad I caught you before everybody else got here. I've had this idea. And in this particular case, you know, people bring a lot of ideas. And if you do a lot of innovation, you get fairly good at sort of handicapping things and understanding, you know, what's a good idea, what's not. And I will just tell you, this is one of the best ideas I had ever heard. This concept was so well thought out. And it fundamentally met like all of the criteria that we would seek to go and prove out to make this a qualified concept. It was incredibly easy for this organization to actually go and execute it. It would have been completely disruptive to their entire space. It was amazing. I just said, let's go proof it out right away. Let's build out our hypothesis and like go qualify this. And right on cue, this person said exactly what people always say after they share an idea. And he said, no, I don't want to do that. I said, well, why not? And he said, because this company could never pull it off. And it's sort of this amazing thing. This here sitting in front of me is the person who is leading all of their deep innovation. And something inside of them doesn't actually believe that their organization can innovate. That brings up some very fascinating questions. Why is that? And so I went back in time in my brain to some of the earlier things that I was noticing about things that I kept sensing around, like, I just don't think this project's going to work. And I started looking at all of these different things that I kept seeing companies do that, you know, none of it was really a crime, right? None of it was really bad. None of it was really something that was catastrophic. In fact, some of these things that people were doing actually, not only were they seen as good, but like people were encouraging them, like, you should, this is a best practice for innovation. You should go off and do this. But what I kept seeing was there was all of these different behaviors going on alongside all the day-to-day things that the net result of them was they were actually teaching your organization that you can't innovate. And it's really, really subtle things. So this is where the anti-patterns actually come from then. It was starting, I started cataloging them, started cataloging the things that I kept seeing over and over again so that I could go in and rather than making sort of a capital case out of it, I could share a funny story or I could give an example of something that everyone could kind of laugh at and go like, oh, okay. But now we've got sort of this fable that goes along with this activity that teaches them that, oh yeah, this is probably something that we really shouldn't do. So thus the anti-patterns were born. And so we try and make a little bit of out of fun out of them. So they have some fun names like altitude sickness or this time will be different or hold my beer or pet shows, or, you know, things like that. So I don't know, you've looked at the website. Is there a particular anti-pattern that jumped out at you that we should talk about?
So first of all, Grant, thank you so much. This is super insightful. There's so much I would love to unpack here. Anti-patterns, I love the way you like humorously phrase them because we have a similar thing we talk about the four horsemen of the apocalypse, which are these like four in your ways anti-patterns. I find an insane power in just getting people an interesting piece of language to play with this. Yeah. And yeah. I've got clients who run around and basically tell me like, oh yeah, and we found the fifth horseman, you know, and they make up their own anti-patterns, which is great. I'm curious because you really have me sitting at the edge of my seat. I love the framing you do around uncertainty. What is the anti-pattern to that? How do you actually overcome? Because presumably you will not fix the uncertainty. Like that will always be somewhat a constant. If anything, it's rising in these days. So how do you overcome the left hand, right hand? I always pick the left hand because it's more certain.
Yeah. So what I tell people is this. The main thing is we need to start off by humanizing innovation. And it's a big, heady thing. But we always talk about things like there's always this aspirational goal of we want to create a culture of innovation. And we don't really do a good job of teaching people what that actually means. We tend to look back historically at other companies that we thought did a great job. And we talk about, oh, look, they had a culture of innovation and we want to do that. And so, you know, we sort of take the side effects of their culture and look at them as if they're actually the root things that create that culture. So, you know, throwing foosball tables or free beer or, you know, whatever it is. And I think there's a better blueprint to go in and actually create this culture. So the anti-pattern to the anti-patterns or the uncertainty problem that leads us to be shutting down things because we're no longer able to tolerate the risk sort of falls into three different buckets. So humanizing innovation is comprised of three components. One, create certain, two, protect the innovators, and three, give each other confidence. So you just made the comment around, well, you can't really eliminate uncertainty. But I believe that we can be deliberate in actually doing just that. I believe that we can take immediate actions when we are responsible for creating the uncertainty. So for instance, I gave the example earlier about a leadership change being one of the major trigger events. One of the most devastating examples of that is when people get promoted. What often happens is someone who's known for innovation sort of becomes like the golden child a little bit for a period of time within an organization, and they're sort of promoted into having more responsibility. And the very ideas or the very projects that they were responsible for that got them on the map now are being reevaluated against, oh my gosh, you know, I used to be responsible for maybe three or five things, but now I've been given a portfolio of 18 things. And when I look at this, it just seems really, really, really risky right now, right? And so they end up shutting down the very thing that actually got them the promotion. Because again, a promotion is a time where you kind of get to clean the slate and you can start over. And beginning new things is very, very easy. So what's the antidote to that? Well, when you're going to promote someone, you can reach into that process and you can say, hey, we're promoting you and we want you to keep moving with the things that you've been working on. We know that they're risky. We know that they're difficult. We know there's a lot of uncertainty and we know we've given you a lot more responsibility and maybe you're going to be overwhelmed by that. And that's okay. We're okay with that. And we want you to be okay with that also. So it's a direct cultural thing that you're doing there, right? You're creating an environment where it's safe. Again, this is the psychological safety element, but we're creating a safe place for that person to have that promotion where they feel there isn't a risk in continuing on with that long-term innovation thing that kind of got them noticed, but maybe isn't done yet, right? So creating certainty also comes where, hey, we're going to merge with another company, or hey, we're going to reorg. Right. And as a part of our reorg, going in and being deliberate about, and we're going to go in and identify all the things beforehand that we want to still exist after, and to carry those things through that uncertainty by calling them out and saying, and our intention is to continue forward with these things. And that's where you can counteract the uncertainty that you're creating. Very, very often we see organizations undertake major initiatives, and the leaders actually don't even realize that major innovation programs are happening. I watched the CEO of a global 20 organization bring up one of their divisions and they were giving a show and tell of all the things they're working on. When they got done, he asked the question. He's like, oh, well, what's going on with this project over here? And you could just see instantly, I instantly knew like, oh, they killed it. And he has no idea they killed it. Because that division had been restructured. They had brought in a couple of new organizations and made them into one organization. And yet in the meantime, they had no idea that that was the CEO's favorite project from the previous year. And he had been out telling analysts and partners and things that they were working on this thing. And now in the moment in front of everybody, you could see the CEO realizing, oh, they killed my favorite thing, right? This is the kind of thing where if you're knowing that you're creating uncertainty and you're reaching into the organization, you can be very, very deliberate about counteracting the uncertainty that you're creating. The next sort of broad thing is to basically come out and say, oh, yeah. So in creating certainty, one, you can recognize when you're causing anxiety, right? Mm-hmm. The two is you can actually build structural mechanisms into your operating model that shield the long-term innovation programs that you've got, so that they are separate from your quarterly or your annual billing or budgeting cycles. So structurally isolate those things. Commit dollars for the long term upfront so that you can't use the budgets for your R&D as sandbags every time you need to trim the budget. Because that's often what leaders look at. Like, oh, this thing's not done. We'll just throw it overboard, right? And then the third thing is believing. It is really, really important when you're creating certainty to demonstrate that when there are facts, we believe them, and that those facts are guiding the decisions that we're making. If your teams are bringing you facts and you are making decisions that run counter to the facts that they're giving you, you are teaching your organization that things are far more uncertain than certain. If you do the opposite, though, and you make your decisions based on those facts, then you are teaching your organization that they can be certain that if they can prove something to be true, that you're going to stick with it and you're going to back them. So that's the first element, is creating certainty. The second one is protecting the innovators. This one actually starts maybe not where people would expect, but it's really around choosing the right people. Not everyone is an innovator. And that's really, really difficult for people to hear. I had an interesting conversation with an IT leader in an interesting med tech company. I said, let's do this exercise. I said, how many people would you need to have to come into work tomorrow if we made the rule that we can no longer improve anything? You could only run things as they were. How many of the existing team would you actually need? And she said, well, barely any. Like, we would, you know, when it comes right down to it, it's very few. And she said, but that's the fun part. But how many people recognize that that's a thing, right? That's the fun part. And yet at the same time, not everyone is equipped to take on the amount of risk that comes with doing long-term innovation or really disruptive innovation. People are often extraordinary at operators, as an operator of an organization, and doing kind of continuous improvement types of things. But you ask them to take these big risks on things, and they just, it's like asking someone to give them a leg cramp over and over and over again. They're constantly in a state of distress, and it's horrible. It's a terrible thing to watch. It really destroys people, and it's awful. So if you're going to do this, the way to protect the innovators is to choose the right people to actually go and do this work. The next piece is, once you've got those right people, you need to be including them in the critical decisions. So just as before we said, you need to be believing the data, you need to be allowing those people to help you do the prioritization. You can't be handing down edicts from on high, well, we just want to go and do this. Instead, you need to bring those people in and allow them to share their data. You can share your data, and now you can have a frank discussion. And if they feel that they've had a hand in actually making the decisions on the things that are moving forward or the prioritization of things, you're going to get far more certainty within the organization. And people are going to feel protected because they'll feel that something didn't happen to them. They were a part of something that was happening. And that especially is critical for, when do we kill off a project? I've been talking about the number one reason that programs fail being that they're shut down. But sometimes shutting things down is a really, really good thing. It's just, you can tell the difference between bad shutdown and good shutdown. Good shutdowns, it maps to something that is part of your process that isn't working out. Again, things like a customer fit, things like the technology challenge we can't overcome. There's no way to pivot around it or change it. Those are healthy. Fail fast. Be done with it. Move on. But allow the team to be involved in that decision and allow them to make the recommendation that this is the time to stop doing this, right? And then the last thing is to isolate those teams. If you're going to protect innovators, you need to get them out of your organization. That team, that group cannot exist under your operating model. It will not succeed. The immune response from the rest of your organization will absolutely destroy it. You cannot have KPIs that are the same for your operating business as you have for your innovation teams. They cannot operate the same way. And then the final category is in giving each other confidence. So this is the kind of thing now that dovetails in with these other two things, where as you decide to shut things down, I guess the better example is, we always talk about doing experiments. And a successful experiment sometimes means that you have proven that something won't work. That is a successful experiment. And we tend to do things based on experiments in our work. And you want that. That's a really, really good thing. But so many companies have this shame that if the outcome didn't include positive numbers, like somehow that was a failure of us. And that's not true. An experiment that has negative numbers in it means that you did a successful experiment that proved that something isn't going to work. And you need to go and celebrate that. So celebrate successful failures. Right? I know it's a weird term of phrase, but it's really important to do it in public and to do it frequently and to model this over and over and over and over again. It's the repetition that makes it actually work. You can't just do it once and say like, oh, look, we failed fast once. Now we've got this covered. The next one is, and this is more one that I just have built up a sensitivity to, so maybe it's not applicable everywhere, but you need to forbid people asking the following question. Where is this being done? This is my least favorite question inside organizations. And what it really means is, I don't like this idea. I think this is a bad idea. This idea just seems like something that I don't personally want to do. And so rather than being negative, because we're creating a really nice and inclusive environment here where we have lots of great ideas, rather than just say, I don't like the idea, or I think it's not going to work, or whatever, people then ask this question, well, where is this being done? And it's a way of shutting down ideas. This is a question that's asked a lot by senior leaders in organizations, because senior leaders have had years of building skills where they know how to keep teams on track and to keep people from diverting off into the weeds and getting pulled into things that are a distraction. And so asking where has this been done is a great way to take distracting things and like short circuit the conversation.
Right.
So when this question comes up, I tend to turn it around and I say, well, I tell people this tends to be something that usually someone has a deeper concern about something. So could you re-ask the question, but really try and focus in on why you think it isn't going to work? But let's ask it in form of what would we need to prove in order for this thing to actually be true and in order for it to be successful? And that's our innovation process. It's what do we need to prove in order for this thing to be true? And so we shift someone from, I'm just shutting this down, by asking to see it somewhere else. Because honestly, if you're doing innovation, especially like Horizon 3 long-term innovation, and you're asking for where this has been done before, you're maybe not the right person to be involved in this team from the beginning, right? So, and then the final element of this is one that I think most people who work in innovation are fairly familiar with, and that is psychological safety. Understanding that people have to be in an environment where they feel that they can say outlandish and stupid and dumb things and it's okay. And more than that, that when people are asking challenging questions, they're asking those challenging questions to make your idea better or to make the thing that you're collectively working on better. They're not tearing it down. They're actually trying to strengthen it and to build it up. And that takes, again, a lot of trust and a lot of demonstration of a lot of the previous things in order to create that environment. So for me, this is a long, very long answer to a very simple question, but what's the anti-pattern to uncertainty? It's basically these three elements, which are creating certainty, protecting your innovators, and giving each other confidence. And I feel like this gives you a really, very simple framework that you can then build a lot of other things around, but it's a starting point for how you can actually build what we often hear referred to as sort of a culture of innovation.
Grant, I could do this for hours. There's so much knowledge in what you just shared. I love this idea around figuring out what is the reality, really anchoring us in assessing reality in a 360 manner, really looking across the borders. And then taking that reality, acknowledging the fact that there is uncertainty and we insert a lot of uncertainty, and then trying to turn that uncertainty into a little bit more of a certainty using the tools you just shared. When does the book come out, my friend? You have to write this like this. I want to read this in a book. I seriously want to read this in a book.
Yeah. Yes, you're not the first to ask. I don't have an answer and I'm not working on one, but I probably ought to.
Let me put some like public pressure on you here, because we need to have that in a book. As said, Grant, I think I could continue this conversation literally for hours and hours. This is really, really fascinating. For everybody who's listening, I highly recommend go to the Notion Labs website. Again, we'll put the link into the show notes, because you do share a lot of these insights. You have the anti-section on your website where you explain these anti-patterns. And my invitation for everybody is, look through those, see where they resonate in your organization. Make up your own anti-patterns if you see others. Maybe share them with Grant. I'm pretty sure, Grant, you love hearing them. I always love hearing the fifth horseman in our case. And again, Grant, thank you so much for spending time with us and really walking us through the way you're thinking about innovation and helping companies to be innovative again, which again, I really love. And yeah, thank you so much. This was great.
Absolutely. It was a real pleasure, and thanks for having me.
Hey, it's Pascal. Thanks for tuning in on this episode of Disrupt Disruption. If you want more, check out the other episodes we have on this podcast. And if you liked it, do us a favor. Go on your podcasting platform of choice, iTunes, Google Play, whatever it is, and leave a quick review. It helps tremendously with getting the insights from our guests out into the world. If you have any questions, send me an email. You can reach me at pascal@finet.com. Thank you so much for listening, and I will hear you here soon.